Dzień dobry Państwu. Chciałbym serdecznie przywitać mimo przeżyć, doświadczeń ubiegłych 10 dni, mimo trudności dojechania, co spowodowało, że musieliśmy zmienić formułę naszego spotkania, dlatego że nasi goście ukraińscy, którzy mieli uczestniczyć w naszej konferencji Ukrainie poświęconej w założeniu, nie mogli dojechać. Stąd w ostatniej chwili postanowiliśmy zmienić formułę. Dojechał jeden gość, też ze wschodu dojechał, prawda, ze Lwowa, Andrew Wilson. I pomyśleliśmy sobie, że to jest dobra okazja, żeby porozmawiać i paradoksalnie nie o Ukrainie, chociaż jak za chwilę powiem, możemy o Ukrainie też mówić, tylko o Rosji, bo Andrew Wilson, który teraz się bardziej specjalizuje problematyce ukraińskiej i jest autorem również wybitnej książki o Rosji, o systemie politycznym Rosji i jest również wybitnym specjalistą Rosji. I ze względu na to, iż problematyka stosunków polsko-rosyjskich, poza oczywiście aspektami wewnętrznymi i poza problemem atmosfery po tragicznej katastrofie w Smoleńsku, to problem stosunków rosyjsko-polskich stał się jednym z dominujących problemów w ostatnich, jak tak naprawdę od siódmego, od spotkania w Katyniu premiera Tuska i premiera Putina. Tyle, że od wypadku w gruncie rzeczy mamy bardzo niewiele refleksji na ten temat, a bardziej natomiast emocjonalnych reakcji na niezwykłe manifestacje sympatii dla Polaków dotkniętych tragedią, zarówno ze strony społeczeństwa, jak i ze strony władz najwyższych Rosji. Otóż pomyśleliśmy sobie, że nie będziemy redukowali naszej konferencji ukraińskiej do minimalnej formuły z jednym uczestnikiem, Andrew Wilsonem, że nie rezygnujemy z konferencji, tylko wręcz przeciwnie, zorganizujemy ją. Porozumiemy się z tymi, którzy mieli przyjechać, żeby zobaczyć, jakie terminy jest dla nich możliwe. I po to, żeby nie powtarzać tej samej tematyki dwukrotnie, raczej skoncentrować się na problemie, który nas również bardzo interesuje, to znaczy na problemie Rosji, przy tym nie tylko polityki zagranicznej Rosji, ale również przemian, czy też perspektyw możliwości zmian wewnętrznych Rosji. Andrew Wilson był już naszym gościem niedawno. On opublikował, tutaj egzemplarze są wydanie polskie jest tutaj chyba u nas na stole, opublikował razem z drugim wybitnym analitykiem European Council on Foreign Relations, Europejskiej Rady Polityki Międzynarodowej, opublikował raport, który, nie pamiętam jak brzmi tytuł polski, ale takim podwójnym sąsiedztwie, to znaczy z jednej strony polityka Unii Europejskiej w stosunku do krajów, które są objęte obecnie Partnerstwem Wschodnim, ale z drugiej strony, i to jest oryginalność podejścia i moim zdaniem niezwykle interesującej analizy, równocześnie analiza polityki rosyjskiej w stosunku do tych samych krajów. Czyli innymi spojrzenie na sytuację tych krajów z podwójnej perspektywy polityki zachodniej i polityki wschodniej wobec tych krajów. Oczywiście nie będziemy tego powtarzali. Spotkanie miało inny charakter, było małe i zamknięte, ale oczywiście te problemy mogą być też przedmiotem naszej dyskusji. Ja chciałbym ze względu na nieformalny charakter w dużym stopniu naszego spotkania i spontaniczny, żebyśmy nie ograniczali naszego tematu. To znaczy, myśmy podali temat ostateczny, prawda, zmiany w polityce wewnętrznej i zagranicznej Rosji. And I think that Andrew will start with it in his introductory speech. Będziemy mówili w dwóch językach, więc jeżeli ktoś z Państwa ma kłopoty z którymś z tych języków, to tam są słuchawki na zewnątrz. To jest usprawiedliwieniem obecności tych słuchawek na zewnątrz. Ale później ja myślę, że najciekawsza część to może być część pytań i odpowiedzi i wtedy możemy rozmawiać nie tylko o Rosji, tylko możemy również rozmawiać o Ukrainie i dotykać innych problemów, które leżą w kompetencji Andrew Wilsona. I think the floor is yours. You will start, and afterwards we will see what will happen. Proszę bardzo.
Thanks, Ali. I'll speak in English. The translators should give me a word if I'm going too quickly or too Englishly. Well, three things. I was expecting to speak at a conference on Ukraine. Maybe I'll save some remarks on Ukraine to the end of my speech. Secondly, Alec asked me to speak a little about the political situation in Russia. I agreed because, thirdly, it would be very interesting to sort of situate that in some of the debates that have been happening in Poland since the tragic events in Smolensk. So firstly, about Russia. Well, there's a lot of discussion, and not just in the West, which is basically Journalistica. This book, for example, Putin and Medvedev, What Next? Constantly speculating on the kind of personal relationship. I think it's more useful to look at structural factors. Firstly, what was the original purpose of what Russians themselves called Operation Successor? Or even Operation Successor 2.0, if the first was Yeltsin to Putin, the second was Putin to Medvedev. Or possibly Operation Appointee. It helps to clarify things a lot if you remember that Medvedev was appointed rather than elected by the people. Well, this operation had the three main purposes. One was to prevent outsider challenges to the regime. Secondly, was to prevent insider problems. Elections and transitions in Russia are always difficult. They always threaten to kind of create a sort of neo-Trotskyist, not permanent revolution, but permanent redistribution of assets, economic assets. That was always a danger, and maintaining this close tandem, as the Russians called it, was the way to avoid that, to prevent not just outsider challenges to the system, but some kind of attempt at aggrandisement from the likes of the Siloviki, Ihor Sechin in particular. The original purpose of the word tandem should be remembered too. In Russia there is a word, dvoye vlastye. Only in Russian perhaps could this be seen as a bad thing. In the liberal West, a division of powers is normally seen as a healthy part of any political system. Whereas in Russia, dvoye vlastye, two powers, conveys this impression of destructive conflict, the danger of anarchy. So the tandem was an alternative word and is basically a steering metaphor. The point of the metaphor is that if you have two guys on a tandem, they have to go together. They can't go in different directions. And you can, of course, even drive a tandem from the back. You often put the stronger guy in the second position. And in order to prevent this war for property, Putin had to stay. Medvedev wasn't strong enough to do it on himself. Putin's role has always been what could be called Lord of the Rings. His job is to kind of sit in the centre of all these circles of interest and maintain a balance between them. The system only works if the various, in Russian, Kruguvaya Poruka, circles of interest are in rough balance. That was when this has not been the case, as with Berezovsky, as with Hodorkovsky. Action had to be taken. So that was the original purpose of Operation Successor. And those three priorities still hold. More exactly, what is the purpose of the division of labour between Putin and Medvedev? Well, originally, it was a kind of prosperity project. Putin would continue acting as Lord of the Rings. Medvedev's job, as I saw it, was to front the kind of new Russia to the West. To, you know, if Putin had stabilised and legitimised the system internally during his original two terms, Medvedev's job was to talk about the rule of law, to gain more international legitimacy, legitimise the division of property. And remember that before the global economic crisis, Russian companies were getting enormous IPOs on the London Stock Exchange, particularly Sechin's, even though it was based on property stolen from Yukos. So this strategy was working. And to attract FDI where possible. So originally it was a prosperity project. Secondly, the division of labour needed to help Russia survive the recession. Putin needed to prevent any kind of further war between the various groups breaking out, because the state was spending a lot of money to keep Russian businesses afloat, and that needed to be roughly even-handed. And again, Medvedev's job was to kind of calm the markets. Thirdly, and now, the worst of the recession is over, and there have been two very different psychological reactions in Russia to that recession. The first, and the one that is least often noticed, is pride, paradoxically. Putin and some of the Siloviki think that that Russia survived a crash test, as Gleb Pavlovsky has put it. The system was stress tested in a way it never had been. It would have collapsed in Yeltsin's years, they argue. It showed its strength. Medvedev represents a very different psychological reaction, because, of course, the global economic crisis, which hit Russia particularly hard, also revealed a huge number of very serious and potentially fatal internal weaknesses. So again, there is a division of labour to kind of marry these two reactions in a nicely dialectical post-Soviet kind of way. Yes, there needs to be modernisation, but the gains of the Putin era, as the elite sees it in terms of stability and so on, need to be preserved. So the solution is Vladislav Surkov's formula of authoritarian modernisation. It is much clearer what this is not. Putin is very clear on the negatives still. If Russia modernises, it will not mean, it must not mean Ukrainianisation, as he calls it, by which he means political chaos, too much competition and disorder. And it won't be like the Gorbachev era, another parallel that is sometimes drawn. And it won't be, thirdly, a kind of neoliberal version advocated by some in the West and broadly identified with the 1990s. So the state will still be in charge. It will be a top-down neo-Soviet project Personally, I think, I'll leave that to a conclusion, it won't therefore work. But Surkov, who is in charge of bridging this division of labour between the kind of neoliberal measures advocated by people like Jurgens and Gontmacher and the kind of do-nothing approach of the Siloviki, Surkov is very much the guy in the middle of all this at the moment. The state will be in charge. There will be an emphasis on big projects, technology borrowing, and state-led corporatist efforts. Such as, for example, the idea that there will be a technology park, a kind of Russian version of, a kind of cross between Silicon Valley and the kind of Akadem Gorodoki that used to exist in the Soviet Union. So this, I think, is the most likely scenario for 2012. Regardless of who is formally in charge, who's prime minister and who's president, the tandem still has a purpose. The tandem is strong because it's survived the redefinition of its purpose. And therefore we're likely to see the two of them still together. It's much less important, in fact, what position they will hold. Alternative scenarios are marginal. It's very difficult now for either of them to get rid of the other. Of course, it's much more feasible that Putin could ditch Medvedev. But if he did that in a traditional fashion via some kind of war of compromat to kind of fatally damage Medvedev, then clearly he would do some damage to the image that he himself has built up over the last 4 years. Another scenario that's sometimes talked about, again I see as marginal, there are some Siloviki who dislike any talk of modernisation and want Putin to return to power on a white horse on the slogan of restoring order. Dumping Medvedev and returning to a sort of much more hardline approach. Again, I don't see that as likely. So my prediction for 2012 is boring. More of the same. Quick word about foreign policy. Here, there are more problems and more paradoxes. Firstly, Russia clearly is using more soft power. This is the point of the report that is translated in front of you. But in many ways, things have changed since that report came out. What's interesting in the kind of projection of foreign policy soft power is that if there is this division between Medvedev and Putin in terms of other functions, it doesn't appear to work in terms of the neighbourhood. The logical thing that one might expect, that Putin was the tough cop and Medvedev the good cop, doesn't consistently apply at all. In fact, sometimes Medvedev acts the bad cop to try and reassure potential hardline critics at home. So there is no division of labour with soft power. Russia has a problem that it combines soft power and hard power in a way that the EU doesn't. The EU doesn't really do hard power. We sometimes try sanctions, but we certainly don't invade people. Some might say that that's a disadvantage, but at least it allows our soft power to work away, however slowly it does. But the kind of hard power precedent that Russia set in 2008, war in Georgia, obviously, is coming back to haunt it in a way that seemed obvious and was predicted by many at the time. That recognition of Abkhazia and South Ossetia would be a bad precedent for Russia's own restive republics. That is exactly what was predicted and exactly what has happened. the situation in the north of Caucasus is pretty scary. I don't have the exact number. I think it was 750, approximately, members of the Interior Ministry were killed in the North Caucasus last year, which is a pretty serious loss of control. Secondly, and most recently, what Russia did in Kyrgyzstan in many ways flies in the face of its recent approach to the neighbourhood, which was that coloured revolution was a bad thing, and that Russia was a kind of bastion against disorder and the spread of and the spread of these kind of events via what was openly called counter-revolutionary technology. So for Russia to support, to clone, if you like, a Russian version of a coloured revolution on its own doorstep, with some of the same technology, softening up the leader with all sorts of compromat on the on the internet before he was forced out, may again have paradoxical consequences. One other point to note is that there is very little sign of a post-energy foreign policy in the neighbourhood. Energy is still at the head of the queue always, which makes a rational use of soft and hard power difficult. And the clearest example of this is Ukraine. Russia's shopping list is extremely long, and Yanukovych seems amazingly amenable to working with it. And the only possible explanation for this is that everything is predicated on cheap Russian gas. And the Yanukovych government is staking everything on getting what it calls Belarusian prices, not just a $30 price cut, but a cut below $200. I think he may be chasing a chimera, but otherwise it is very difficult to explain the sheer number of concessions that have been made. Here, of course, I'm moving on to Ukraine, but I'll try and keep two subjects separate. The abolition of committees on Euro-Atlantic integration, the very real discussion of the possibility of abolishing the law passed in 2003 that sets Ukraine's basic Euro-Atlantic foreign policy direction, and replacing it with a law specifically saying Ukraine would be neutral and pause a block order. Not participate in any blocs. A huge range of concessions to the Russian business interests, such as Ukrtelecom and the Odessa ammonia plant, which was a big controversy last year. And not just the renewal of the lease on the Black Sea fleet, but some kind of Guantanamo style 30 or 50 year lease. So a huge range of questions, all predicated on cheap gas. Russian foreign policy in the neighbourhood is still Putinist. Medvedev is still window dressing here. Russia is still pushing a sphere of influence project. The only division of labour between them that I can see, it is a bit corporate. Sometimes Medvedev pushes things that are close to the interests of Gazprom. In Ukraine, for example, it's said that the gas lobby reports to Medvedev in Moscow, whereas Putin is more interested with Sechin in expanding Russia's role in the nuclear sector. Some quick conclusions about Russia. One is depressing, in that every election is a crisis. Every election needs to have a plan. These bizarre names that they have, Operation Successor every time, which is not normal. Even if, for countries with highly controlled political systems, elections ought to be less life-threatening. but every time they seem to be. Secondly, I don't think authoritarian modernisation will work. That's a personal opinion, but it looks far too neo-Soviet to me. If you think back as recently as 2007, 2008, Medvedev was gifted something similar, the kind of four modernisations, which improved his public image, but were a colossal waste of money. Very little impact for the amount of money that was spent. It seems far too top-down, far too monolithic, far too state-controlled. Not really what Russia needs. Shall I say 5 minutes about Ukraine? Okay.
Go on.
Right, okay. Firstly, Tymoshenko, I think, lost the election rather than the other way around. There are several counterfactuals in which she could quite clearly have won. Her biggest problem was incumbency. About a year ago, there was some complacency, of which I was also guilty, because she'd survived the initial stages of the economic recession without too big a hit on to her popularity. There was a certain complacency, but in the end, in the eyes of many voters, it damaged her a lot, as did her response, which was short-termist, hand-to-mouth. She didn't manage relation to the IMF very well. She emphasised welfare, continuing state subsidisation, which created the political space for Tikhanov's campaign, which appealed much more to new business, middle-class Ukrainians concerned with the burden of tax. She could have, there was an attempt to force her out of office in February 2009. If that had succeeded and she had fought as leader of the opposition, who knows? Secondly, she was almost without allies in the second round. Even one or even two deals with the minor candidates ought to have given her enough votes for victory, as the margin was so small. Most obviously Yushchenko. Yushchenko got 5% of the vote, more than the winning margin, and persuaded most of his supporters not to vote for her in round two. He did for it in the end. That's his last note in the history books, and rather a sad one, having devoted so much time to stabbing her in the front so that she would not become president. He got what he wanted. Now, in Poland, you're very concerned about Bandera. This is doubly depressing because it was blatantly political. Yushchenko did this deliberately between the rounds as a gift to Yanukovych to mobilise his supporters. So in many ways, we shouldn't argue about it. We should just pretend it never happened. Tymoshenko also lost because she couldn't do deals with the other candidates, most notably Tikhanov. Tymoshenko lost because she was too cynical. There were some political, so-called political technology deals that she had made. For example, people close to her had paid the communists. The deal was that they would be surprisingly neutral in round two, and the voters would therefore not back Yanukovych. That didn't happen. All of their vote went to Yanukovych. A key factor underlying this and all of this is Tymoshenko's cynicism. I think the biggest mistake in terms of political manoeuvring she made was the abortive deal with Yanukovych himself in June last year. This didn't happen, but it demonstrated to many voters that she would do anything. And most importantly, undermined her best narrative, which was that she was keeper of the orange flame, that Yushchenko was a failure, and that she was the anti-Yushchenko. Once she was prepared to divide up the country, basically, into a kind of Dvoye Vlastye, her part and Yanukovych's part, that fatally undermined that narrative. Yanukovych did some things right. He kept his basic base electorate, although he didn't expand it. So his mandate is very geographically limited. And he kept his potentially fractious party united. At least until now. The Party of Regions is basically a kind of joint stock company. Normally it functions well if there is no majority shareholder. It's a bit like the idea of the Lord of the Rings again, that the leader of the party has to keep the various business groups in check. At the moment, because politically so much is staked on the gas question, that is destabilising the balance between the Ukrainian oligarchs as well. Too much power has gone to the gas group, which is Boyko, Livochkin and Firtash, and too little, surprisingly, to Ukraine's richest man, Rinat Akhmatov. In fact, even one of your reports that I was reading yesterday said Akhmatov is the biggest winner from the elections. This doesn't seem to be true. There is a basic mathematical problem underlying the situation, which is that Dmytro Firtash lost two things in 2009. One was that Ros Ukrainego was dismantled. The other is that Tymoshenko, with Gazprom's agreement, transferred all the gas that he had in underground storage just over the border in West Ukraine to Naftogaz Ukraini. Crudely, Firtash wants his gas back and has invested heavily. In fact, all the signs are that he, and not Akhmatov, we're off the record, aren't we? Was the main investor in Yanukovych's campaign. So he expects a return, which is why he's so over-prominent at the moment. So the new government is emphasising Russia much more than one might have expected. When Yanukovych made his first visit as president to Brussels. Everything seems to be predicated on this risky gamble for cheap gas. I say it's risky because Moscow and Gazprom were actually quite happy with last year's contract. Western European markets are weak, and Ukraine was paying a very high price, almost compensating for the lack of revenue in the West. And Russia was effectively pimping us, the West, for various loans and short-term methods for Ukraine to keep that payment going. So Russia may prove not to be, in fact, as willing to cut price as Ukraine assumes. A second surprise and worry is that the Party of Regions seems not to have changed its basic patronage and authoritarian instincts. The method by which the government created was unconstitutional, full stop. So for the Constitutional Court to say otherwise was spineless and corrupt. Additionally so, because there is now a flood of more deputies to the government side. There are at least 260, with some talking of a constitutional majority of 300. The government is packing the judiciary with its own supporters. Even Ukraine's noisy and much valued free media is under threat. Two of its famous marathon chat shows have been closed already. Others have come under pressure as to the kind of guests that they have. So the picture in Ukraine is not good. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Proszę Państwa, zaczniemy dyskusję, pytania. Inicjatywa należy do Państwa. Bardzo, bardzo proszę. Kto z Państwa chciałby zabrać głos? Proszę bardzo. I bardzo proszę o przedstawianie się, dlatego żebyśmy w zarejestrowanej wersji, żebyśmy wiedzieli, kto mówi.
Sadowski Jeremi. Pierwsze pytanie o rolę cerkwi w Rosji. Tutaj nie było o tym mowy, więc po prostu ciekaw byłbym, jak pan to widzi. Czy to jest rola przyszłościowa, czy to jest ocieplanie wizerunku, czy cerkiew może w pewnych warunkach odgrywać rolę niezależnego, w jakiejś mierze niezależnego czynnika politycznego. To jest jedno pytanie, a drugie o determinację ze strony Rosji w utrzymaniu blisko siebie krajów Partnerstwa Wschodniego. Jak daleko ta determinacja idzie? Czy może prowadzić do jakiegoś potencjalnego starcia, czy jakiejś konfrontacji z Unią Europejską?
Firstly on the church. The church is very important in terms of Russian soft power abroad, particularly, of course, in the Orthodox abroad. It was very interesting, for example, in the two Moldovan elections last year, that although Voronin was happy to be photographed with Medvedev, the photo opportunity that he really wanted was with the Patriarch. That was very important, and it was splashed all over the Moldovan media. He didn't win, but this actually helped. It was a big factor in politics at home. The Patriarch puts a different accent on things. I mean, going further back, there was a kind of stronger disagreement, an interesting one, when the church was slightly critical of the war in Georgia, in that it expressed regret that brother Orthodox nations were fighting each other, which was quite out of step with the Kremlin. Normally, though, it's a question of accent. The Patriarch's recent trip to Ukraine was very interesting because Russians traditionally get the brotherly love rhetoric wrong because it's never equal enough. So it doesn't work in Ukraine as well as it might. But the Patriarch got that, well, the way that he phrased it was more receptive to Ukrainian ears. He said, "My soul is divided. Legally, I wish I could have two passports, a Russian one and a Ukrainian one," which went down well. If you remember the election of the Patriarch, I can't remember the exact numbers, but at least a third of those who elected him, remember, were from Ukraine in particular. Moldova as well, although it's a small country. So, yes, in many ways, the church is the most powerful extant post-Soviet institutional form of soft power. To a limited degree in the Baltic, in Estonia and Latvia as well. I wouldn't say it's independent, but it does have a different accent sometime. Because clearly the leadership is state-controlled. What are the main points of tension in the eastern neighbourhood between the EU and Russia? Of the six states, Georgia's operation successor may be a problem. That's not necessarily directly a problem between caused by the EU, but Russia's original plan was to hang Saakashvili by the balls, remember? they certainly assumed he would fall. Then they hoped they would get him out of office during his second term. At the moment, not only does he look likely to survive that, but he may, like Putin, redefine his role as some kind of in some kind of different position or power behind the throne. That would be a very, very awkward outcome for Russia, and they may try and destabilise the situation. Ukraine, obviously, though the point of tension here will probably be in a year or so, whether the gas deal sticks or not. With Belarus, Lukashenko will win re-election in February, I think. But I think we should keep an eye on Belarus because the economic problems there are in many ways bigger than in other states. In that the basic Lukashenko model is no longer viable. Russia is not prepared to pay the same subsidies it was. The kind of social welfare model that Lukashenko was able to afford to keep his voters happy is no longer affordable. So Belarus is the state where things really have to change in some way, and that may make it a future point of tension.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Andrew, the first one, I'm sorry, I'm very, very sorry for my English language. I haven't many occasion to speak in English.
It's much better than
then,
my Polish.
Then explain me to, allowed me to speak Polish. Użył pan tutaj terminu i powiedział pan o autorytarnej modernizacji. Ten termin autorytarnej modernizacji opisuje często strategie stosowane w Chinach, opisuje strategie stosowane właśnie w Rosji, ale także oczywiście jest, można go użyć do opisu tego, co się dzieje, czy co się nie stało na Ukrainie po pomarańczowej rewolucji, a także tego, co się stało, czy co się nie stało w Gruzji. Mowa tutaj o głębokich zarzutach do Saakaszwili, o właśnie bardzo autorytarny model zarządzania czy sprawowania władzy. Otóż chciałem tylko niejako wskazać, że tu, w tych rejonach krajów postkomunistycznych, także w Chinach, my mamy problem, bardzo głęboki problem, z rozumieniem różnicy między strategią autokratyczną, a więc strategią, która się realizuje poprzez narzucanie rozwiązań, ale za tymi narzucanymi rozwiązaniami stoi u przywódcy autentyczna wiedza, umiejętność i determinacja. Otóż w tym modelu autokratyzm jest przeciwieństwem strategii autorytarnej. Autorytarysta, my się tutaj tym dużo zajmujemy, to jednak z reguły człowiek charakterologicznie słaby. W każdym razie czuje się wciąż zagrożony. To jest także człowiek pozbawiony dobrej wiedzy, prawda? I przede wszystkim jest człowiekiem pozbawionym umiejętności w sferze rządzenia państwem, ale także zarządzania jego administracją. Więc jak nie wie, jak rządzić, jak nie wie, jak zarządzać, próbuje rozkazywać. Gdybym chciał wskazać jakiś model takiego właśnie, takiej strategii autokratycznej, a więc strategii, która dla mnie mieści się w modernizacji demokratycznej, wolnorynkowej, to mamy taki znakomity przykład. To jest u nas w Polsce Leszek Balcerowicz. On z ogromną wiedzą, z determinacją, ale także z odpowiednią umiejętnością zmodernizował na odpowiednim poziomie polską gospodarkę, finanse publiczne. I teraz my w tych rejonach widzimy te przykłady, pojedyncze przykłady udanej, autokratycznej modernizacji i być może w innych krajach z podobną wizją próbuje się modernizować państwo w innych sferach. Ale jak powiadam, jeżeli za tym nie stoi odpowiednia wiedza, umiejętność, wiedza i umiejętność w tym klasycznym pojęciu episteme i techne, to niestety bardzo łatwo wejść na drogę autorytarnych modeli. I kiedy obserwuję to, co się stało, czy nie stało na Ukrainie, prawda, ten upadek Juszczenki, kiedy obserwuję upadek poparcia i jakby autorytetu Saakaszwili, to ja widzę w tym także ten problem. Oni nie umiejąc wprowadzać jakby modernizacji właśnie w tym europejskim, ale także i amerykańskim stylu, no chcąc nie chcąc stosowali modele bardzo autorytarne. Dlaczego ja do pana o tym mówię? Dlatego, że tylko tak naprawdę w socjologii amerykańskiej, tylko w amerykańskiej jakby wiedzy o naukach społecznych i politycznych, ta wiedza i świadomość tego rozróżnienia, czym jest autokratyzm, czym jest autorytaryzm, istnieje. To jest dobrze opisane. Więc z pewnego punktu widzenia, tutaj tylko pan ma w swoim ręku narzędzia, narzędzie z tej właśnie kultury amerykańskiej, która pozwala przyglądać się problemom tej części Europy, ale myślę, że nie tylko Europy. W ogóle problemom modernizacyjnym w różnych innych kontynentach, kulturach, bez względu właśnie, jak mówię, także na religię. Pozwala przyglądać się i oceniać je z tego właśnie punktu widzenia. Jak powiadam, to z tym rozróżnieniem i umiejętnością wyciągania wniosków z tej sytuacji, ja tutaj na obszarze nie tylko Europy Środkowo-Wschodniej, nie tylko polskiej Europy Środkowo-Wschodniej, ale także w ogóle Europy się nie spotkałem. Jak powiadam, to istnieje tylko w kulturze amerykańskiej. Dziękuję.
Jerome, maybe I will add to this question a few elements about, from this point of view, fascination of Russia with the Chinese model. To what extent there are much closer relation between party to party, which is quite amazing, between Chinese Communist Party and Putin's party now. And there is certain fascination with technology of power. To what extent they are still fascinated with the with the model of economic management and economic transformation, and the second part, to what extent the concept which was Surkov's concept introduced by Surkov about sovereign democracy, which was sort of democratic legitimization of authoritarian Putin's system, to what extent it still exists, and if not, what was it replaced by? As an ideological concept, sovereign democracy.
Very interesting questions. Well, of the three countries you mentioned, with Russia you have this... I mean, part of the fascination with China is counterfactual. What we should have done under Gorbachev. So therefore it's a historical debate that isn't relevant. Russia... Well, political technologists like Pavlovsky like to boast that the Kremlin is a ratingocracy. Right? That they are obsessive about opinion polling to provide information. Yes, but this is in order to perfect the system of control. That's what it's used for. Russia has political technologists who are uber cynical and highly manipulative. It doesn't have a decent bureaucracy because of the emphasis on administrativni vertical. So it's all about orders. So there's no culture of debate, discussion of a professional bureaucracy. Thirdly, Russia has a Siloviki businessmen who are spectacularly poor, who waste huge amounts of money. The quality of management in Rosneft or even Gazprom is terrible. If you look at the amount of money that's been spent, wasted on nanotechnology, it's shocking. So crudely, if we're talking about knowledge and skill in Russia, it isn't there. I don't think. There certainly isn't the kind of bureaucracy, the kind of, crudely, Confucianism that you have in China. Second country, Georgia. In Georgia, the debate is between Europeanists and Singaporeists. So they think they can combine a relatively light controlled political system with much more of an emphasis on small and medium business, which is very different to Russia. That you get this... it reminds me of Britain in the 1980s. All government is bad, no tax, no regulation. The EU is a kind of bureaucratic monster that wants to strangle small business. So you have that very precise combination where there are some possibilities for success because there is such a relative freedom for small and medium enterprise. Third country, Ukraine. Can we put it in this picture? I don't think there was any consistent pattern in Ukraine after 2004. There was certainly no unified political class. There was an over-concentration on political infighting, very little managerial skill, with some islands of excellence. Rehori Nemiria tried to set up this European centre within government. So I wouldn't call Ukraine autocratic, I'd just call it hopeless. Again, the quality of its political class was extremely low. Actually, one interesting exception is Ukrainian business culture is genuinely different to Russia's. Ukrainian businesses don't have the massive rents that Gazprom has. They have to try much harder if they want to sell things, if they want loans, if they want IPOs. So there has been a kind of more interesting shift in some corporate business culture. Akhmetov, for example, recreated his business empire with these sister companies, with relative openness, and run by Western-trained guys with Harvard MBAs. Now, this is interesting. It's a work in progress, but there's probably been more change in the corporate sector in Ukraine than in the political or the bureaucratic sphere. Alex's question about sovereign democracy. One reason it isn't talked about so much now is because it's safe. The threat is over. You know, there is no threat of a coloured revolution anymore. The Russian liberal remnants of the 90s are no threat at all to the powers that be. But it's still there. In fact, the second reason why it's talked of less is that Russia sees it as a successful concept, which it now is refining and discussing with the likes of China. That the global economic crisis showed the weaknesses of the and the fallacies in the Washington consensus, and there's now a Beijing and even a Moscow consensus. All the BRICS share similar ideas about their own protecting their own culture and national paths. So as a concept, it certainly hasn't gone away. But with Surkov, it's like phase two. You know, what do you build on the basis of sovereign democracy? So it's there, and now we have modernization as the kind of second phase.
Tadeusz Hawiera. I have two questions. First, about the proposal of Medvedev about the Euro-Atlantic Security Arrangement Treaty. He still insists, quite recently at Brookings, he said that the proposal has nothing against NATO, European Union, or other organizations like this. So how do you understand it, and how do you see the future of this prospect? And another one, idea posed recently by Secretary Rasmussen. He said that he sees possibility to establish a certain roof of security, common roof from Vladivostok to Vancouver concerning the anti-missile defense system. Do you see any chances to include Russia? In what way it could be done?
No. I would like to ask about Kyrgyzstan. Yeah. No, it's Krzysztof opposes this question. Anyway, I would like to ask you about Kyrgyzstan with the permission of Krzysztof Bobiński. Yeah. Do you believe that it was the popular revolt or the coup orchestrated from abroad? And frankly speaking, orchestrated by Russia. What was the Russian involvement in this?
And then your question will be.
Well, it's my fault, I suppose, that I mentioned Kyrgyzstan, though we're kind of really stretching my alleged expertise here. Was it orchestrated by Russia? I mean, the only piece of evidence that I have that was mentioned was that some of these internet stories about Bakayev were being fed by Russia. That seems established. It clearly was a factor. I don't know. Too early to tell. It would be too rash to tell. Though my good friend Lucan Way, who is an American political scientist, has a very good term about rotten door revolutions. Kyrgyzstan seems to be another one of these, and it probably was back in 2005 as well. The regime had simply grown too weak, and that was obvious. And Lucan also says that rotten door revolutions never turn out well, right? Because they tend to be too anarchic. They don't. There's no institutional continuity. You don't have constitutional order, obviously. So the precedents are not good for future success. On the Euro-Atlantic Security Treaty, Russia keeps changing its definition of what it wants, although its underlying purposes are fairly consistent and clear. A re-emphasis of state sovereignty at the expense of existing collective institutions. Now, some of those are good. We can debate NATO, the OSCE, but clearly some are of more value than others and need preserving, whereas there are big problems with some parts of the post-war, post-Cold War security architecture, you know, the collective security, the weapons treaty, etc. Russia wants to re-establish national sovereignty, as I say, and to the extent of giving Russia a veto power in any putative European security system. Obviously, that's not in our interest. So we have this sort of slightly strange situation where Russia has fed into a discourse about the imperfections in the post-Cold War security architecture, which is real. But its proposals don't really suit us. So everything is parked in the Corfu process under the umbrella of the OSCE with not much happening. For good reason, because it's very difficult to take the Russian proposals forward in a constructive way as they are formulated. Now, Ukraine could arrive on a white horse. Certainly, it's very noticeable that Ukraine talks about, says two things. Ukraine is very interested in the initiative because Ukraine is the biggest missing piece in the jigsaw puzzle as they see it, particularly without a NATO map. So they're very interested in innovative security thinking. They would be interested in getting on this, on the discussion, on board the discussion, if it was actually moving. Because it isn't, then the Ukrainians are coming up with ideas of their own, which may or may not fly. One is to revive and expand the Budapest Memorandum from 1994. The other is to kind of hold a kind of European Security Forum open debate and discussion in Kiev. So the Russians, I mean, if you want to be nice to the Russians, they've done us a service by pointing out some of the areas of deficiency, but I don't think we can throw out the baby with the bathwater. Anything that we do has to be Helsinki plus rather than Helsinki minus. on Rasmussen's proposal. I think Rasmussen has, in his first speeches, has hit the right tone. You know, it's a classic formula. If you have a problem, you de-emphasise the areas of conflict. You try and play up the areas where practical cooperation is possible. Piracy, whatever. I'm no expert whatsoever on the missile security question. But it's certainly an area where we could have a dialogue with the Russians. I've no idea what the practical possibilities are. Germany wants to take this a bit further by inviting Russia to join NATO. I don't think that would work. But Rasmussen's approach, I think, is a good one. You know, find practical areas where we can work together as a way forward.
Gerhard Gnauk, Die Welt. Mr. Wilson, I haven't been here the first 5 minutes. I hope I'm not asking what you said exactly then, but perhaps not. We've had two events in the last weeks. First, the terrorist attacks, one of them under the center of Secret Service FSB in Moscow and declared by the obvious, well, authors as a greeting to the Secret Service, so to the service of Putin. And afterwards I watched Russian TV and I had the impression of Putin being very shocked. This, of course, is a TV image. Maybe this was a message he wanted to give. I don't know. But anyway, that's the first thing. And the second, of course, the horrible plane crash. Two events of which one might say that they appear to be blows against Putin and against his interests. Of course, there may be second thoughts about it. Were there any structures in the state which wanted such things to happen or were interested in it? So could you perhaps give us a brief picture of the secret services or further of the Siloviki structures? Is there infight between them and how are they related to the centers of power you showed us, which means, well, government, Putin and Medvedev. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to ask you what you think of Alex Smola's article published at the weekend in Gazeta Wyborcza. I don't. Well, you know, I mean, you have to be up on these things. No, basically, if I could just put it in maybe one sentence, and I hope I get it right, this is basically there is a fundamental shift in Russian policy towards Europe and away from, because of a fear of a future threat from China. Would that be okay?
About myself, but in a way to introduce you to atmosphere here, there's as I told on the very beginning, there's a lot of talk on Polish-Russian relations, and in extremely emotional and positive sense that there is a prospect of reconciliation, of closing really the historical gap, recognition of cutting behavior of Medvedev, and especially Putin, which is one more example of not banal, let's say, in the foreign policy, not this division which is internally quite visible. In the Polish case, rather Putin was the initiator, not Medvedev at all. And the question I pose, what are the real reason of this certain change we can observe, at least from the September the 1st, when Putin came for the anniversary of the Second World War, which is quite courageous discussion, a decision on his side, because everybody was talking about Ribbentrop-Molotov, and he knew about it, that it would be one of the subjects. So several, let's say, banal hypotheses that first, that they wanted just to show that they are not responsible for the cutting too, which was quite obvious. For the second, that may be quite possible that Putin found in the Polish case his own field of international presence, because the Western, especially Obama and others, are trying in a way to marginalize him, which is a certain game. After the third, of course, better relation with Poland, and now the two serious ones, that in reality the biggest stake is really the Russian-German relations. And there's understanding on both sides, on the side of Germany, and this is quite visible in the policy of Mrs. Merkel, that the high level of anxiety, of lack of trust in the Polish case and the other countries of the region, of the rapprochement, German-Russian rapprochement, can play against both Germany and Russia. And I'm interpreting this initiative of Putin as, in a way, also just to show to Poles goodwill that there is no danger, to build a trust. But the real partner is Germany. And the third, the last thesis, that quite possibly we can see a sort of geopolitical orientation of Russia, that the real problem for them, although rarely they speak about it, this is China, this is the Muslim world outside and inside, that with the US, in spite of signing the agreement, they know very well that they are not anymore real partner. This is not Cold War situation. And all this modernization business they are talking about, and the recognition problem, that the Europe is the only one which can deliver. So after improving very much and very close relation with Germany, with France, with Italy, in a way, Poland is the next objective, but the real objective is rapprochement European-Russian. Well, Krzysztof forced me to repeat myself in a way in foreign language. So now, turn is yours. And you must be gentle because I'm sitting just...
I will read it, of course. You have an English version?
It will be, but it's not yet.
All right. Wow, very interesting. Maybe it would be better if I listened to a more general discussion on Poland and Russia, which would be interesting. On the Siloviki question, well, I mentioned that one of the marginal possibilities, as I see it, for 2012... is this idea of Putin returning on a kind of Silovikist program of poriadok, order, and ditching all the kind of liberal outreach that's going on at the moment. There is clearly a kind of penumbra of dissatisfaction amongst some of the Siloviki. Any rapprochement was not their kind of modus operandi with anybody. And of course they want to maintain their economic interests. There is a kind of penumbra of talk about some kind of provocation, some kind of means of pushing Putin in this direction. I have no evidence whatsoever that the terrorist attack in Moscow was part of that. More, it seems crystal clear that it's a problem of control in the North Caucasus. Blowback. And here you have a very interesting discussion, partly in this book, which says there are three strategies that Russia has in the North Caucasus. The first it calls Kadyrovist. You know, clearly, Russia has created a monster that it can't control. And his methods are spreading to neighbouring republics. It actually advocates a mixture of what it calls number two, Suvorovism, a kind of traditional Russian proconsular approach, with more elements of number three, which it calls the British imperial approach, which is co-opting a broad enough strata of local elites to create effective local government that isn't based on the rape of the local economy. So you co-op locals, but it has to be a sufficiently broad strata to be effective. So the events in Moscow quite clearly are because Russia has no control. It relies on Kadyrov, and he's making the problem worse. The Siloviki power structure. Yes, there are factions. But to go back to the metaphor of the Lord of the Rings, Putin is actually slightly less of a Silovikist than he used to be, because he's in the centre of this system. So he relies a lot more on Sechin as the kind of link to controlling the Siloviki, which is both an advantage and a disadvantage, because it means that Sechin can insert his own agenda. But on Russia and Poland, perhaps, I should listen more and others should speak more.
Please.
Are there any more questions? Yes, please.
Hello, Andrzej Babinski. I have a question. I was wondering, because at some point you touched upon the theme of modernization in Russia and how sort of we've moved from sovereign democracy to this phase of modernization, which you seem to be extremely pessimist about. Recently in the papers there was a mention of two competing projects for technology parks, one that was basically sponsored by Medvedev, the other sponsored by Putin. I don't know how much of this is true. This was just a short press notice. Why are you this pessimist about this phase of modernization that seems to be happening? Is it just because it's Russia, or sort of are there arguments for this?
Well, Surkov gave an interview recently in which he said Russia should create a technology park. We should invite foreign experts. It would be like Kitaygorod for them. Was it Kitaygorod?
Kitaygorod.
Yeah, the kind of enclave that Westerners lived in Moscow in you know the Middle Ages. Which is crazy. Yeah. As if the most highly mobile, you know, intelligent, employable people in the world are going to work in Russia under those kind of conditions. It's mad. So the weakness in all this is how do you let 1,000 skills bloom? You know, where you know you need the army of small and medium businesses. Russia has the skill base, but the proposals to exploit it and under conditions of estate service is just quasi-medieval, it seems to me. It's crazy. And the things that won't work are size, like too many big projects, state leadership under monopoly conditions, so too much risk of poor spending, and sort of technology, well, I was going to say theft, technology borrowing or technology leapfrogging. I mean, you can do some things with that, but you can't leap straight to the Russia of today, from the Russia of today to this, you know, high technology future. You can't have bad roads and nanotechnology. Most successful modernization projects build the base first, right? The education system in particular. And Russia's used to be good, but is now appallingly corrupt. As is Ukraine's. I remember that there was a famous scandal. The first scandal of the Orange Revolution was about a guy who had faked a PhD at university. And basically, it was a problem because it was Colombia. And people said, oh, у нас нормально. So he faked a real PhD. That was supposed to be the problem. So Russia is trying to take too many shortcuts and too many kind of top-down magic solutions. One or two of which may work, but the kind of way in which they would combine, I don't see the way in which they would combine and create any healthy dynamic at all. In part because of the problems that were raised about lack of leadership and bureaucratic skill.
Elżbieta Kasa, Instytut Spraw Publicznych. I would like to only ask, what is your point of view? What are the prospects to sign new partnership and cooperation agreement between the EU and Russia? What, in your point of view, are the main problems on both sides to sign this agreement? What the EU should insist on? I do not know the negotiating mandate, but maybe you have the better sources than me. Okay.
Visas, as always, is the biggest problem. Well, compared to the agreement being negotiated with Ukraine, it's much, much smaller and more technical. Europe thought it had won the argument with Ukraine about a deep free trade agreement. And at the moment, it seems to be being reopened. I don't think it is in Ukraine's interest to join a customs union with Russia, but at least that's now being discussed. Whereas in Russia, that is thought by many to be a viable project. So you don't have the kind of deep free trade parts in that agreement that you do with Ukraine and EU, where the problems are with particular oligarchs, you know, in airports, in particular. So the Spanish presidency raised the visa issue early on in its presidency, and has kind of pushed this attempt to move the dialogue on that forward. My sense is that the visa thing will happen across the board relatively quickly, if not relatively slowly. I.e., if Ukraine gets some things, and then so will Russia, and Ukraine is pinning everything on 2012, which is a good and a bad thing. It allows Ukraine to be lazy by hoping that everything will be temporarily suspended and then permanently suspended for football reasons. Whereas Moldova actually is being a bit more constructive. It has this slogan of preemptive implementation. That instead of just saying new passports and better border control are intrinsically a good thing, whether the EU asks for it or not, they're actually doing it. So they're introducing biometric passports next year. So Moldova might get further ahead. That's broadening the discussion out, but I think that's the nature of the problem. That visas are key, and that the visa issue depends. It is a pan-European issue as much as it is a bilateral one.
Dziękuję bardzo. Czy są jeszcze jakieś pytania? Ty chcesz jeszcze, Krzysztof?
I don't want to let you get away without talking more about Poland and Russia. And this business. No, this business of Putin. When it's actually here in Poland, everything has been said about this. And someone mentioned that when the submarine sank, Putin went, you know, just, we have lots of submarines. This time, when this accident happened, he behaved completely differently. And this embrace with with Tusk will go down in history, but cynically you could say they were embracing over the death of a man neither liked very much. But still, it was a very emotional gesture. So, is Putin changing? Or is this just theater? I mean, because you're an expert on the Putin-Medvedev relationship. Well, you know, is something happening here or not?
Well, obviously, I'm a bit scared to talk about something that's so important to all of you. Well, emotional moments aren't epiphenomenal. You know, they change things. Just like that. You know, I'm an emotional kind of guy. Move me. Precisely because, I mean, I note that you call it Smolensk rather than Katyn 2, because obviously it's not. But as soon as you heard, you thought, this is the most unbelievable paradox ever, that people should be killed when Putin was already making some steps, you know, to do the right thing in terms of, not the fully right thing, but in the right direction. Well, one thing that, Alec, you didn't mention is oil and gas. Is part of it about that?
Absolutely.
Maintaining the existing networks, the shale. Is Russia scared of the shale gas?
This is exactly one of the arguments I used, that this is, is one of the arguments.
Russia?
No. I said what I had to say. It's your turn.
Well, there is a big strategic realignment that Russia wants. I mean, that's one of the reasons for the Medvedev initiative, which is already quite old. Russia is a bit fed up with being lectured by Europe. And it sees that the jigsaw puzzle is moving in its favour. I mean, it's partly repeating what you said anyway. The Spanish presidency was obviously Russian-friendly. France and Germany are traditional friends. With Italy, the personal relationship is good, albeit mercurial. With Britain, the problems of the... on the Russian side, it's perceived that the problems of... our ambassador and the Litvinenko affair have been put behind, though we continue to raise it where necessary. And Russia looks at the map. Russia looks at the big states in a kind of geopolitical jigsaw puzzle kind of way. And so Poland is key. It's the other big state. Sweden has also has seemed to have done the right thing over Nord Stream. So Russia thinks the big states are moving in its favour, and Poland, it hopes, is next. That's certainly the impression that I get, and it's also the impression that I get from being given a hard time in Moscow sometimes, when I'm alleged to be stirring up trouble, turning the EU against Russia. Whereas my job is more to find the centre of gravity in the EU.
Bardzo i powrócimy do problematyki ukraińskiej, bardziej na Ukrainie skoncentrowani, jak tylko zdołamy z innymi uczestnikami się porozumieć co do terminu konferencji. Dziękuję Państwu bardzo.